Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
In this ad for the Mobile One brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobile One, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
Welcome to Washington Today for December 4th, 2023. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us. The White House is warning that time is running out for Congress to approve more assistance to Ukraine. White House Budget Director Shalonda Young wrote in a letter today that inaction from Congress before the end of the year on a new round of aid threatens to, quote, kneecap Ukraine on the battlefield. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, a U.S. Navy warship has intervened after three commercial ships in the Red Sea came under attack by drones. Yemen's Houthi rebels claimed responsibility for the attack, and at the United Nations, Israeli officials are saying that the international body is, quote, ignoring evidence of sexual violence by Hamas terrorists in their October 7th attacks. We'll hear from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, State Department spokesman Matt Miller, and Senate leaders on all of this coming up. In Miami, a former U.S. diplomat was arrested on charges of secretly working to promote Cuban interests in the U.S. Victor Manuel Rocha has been charged with conspiracy to act as a foreign agent to defraud the United States, acting as an illegal agent for a foreign government, and use of a passport obtained by false statement. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the charges at the Department of Justice today. We'll hear from him coming up in a few minutes. We begin at the White House and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
On Ukraine, as you've all seen earlier today, OMB Director Shalonda Young sent a letter to congressional leaders, which Corrine was just referencing, explaining that without congressional action, the administration will run out of resources by the end of the year to procure more weapons and equipment for Ukraine and to provide equipment from U.S. military stocks without impacting our own military readiness. The resources Congress has provided for Ukraine and other national security needs have halted Russia's advances in Ukraine, helped Ukraine achieve significant military victories, including taking back more than 50% of the territory that Russia had previously occupied, and by revitalizing our own defense industrial base, jumpstarting and expanding production lines, and supporting good-paying jobs across the country. Now it's up to Congress. Congress has to decide whether to continue to support the fight for freedom in Ukraine as part of the 50-nation coalition that President Biden has built, or whether Congress will ignore the lessons we've learned from history and let Putin prevail. It is that simple, it is that stark a choice, and we hope that Congress, on a bipartisan basis, will make the right choice.
In that letter, White House Budget Director Shalonda Young stated, quote, without congressional action, by the end of the year, we will run out of resources to procure more weapons and equipment for Ukraine and to provide equipment from U.S. military stocks. There is no magical pot of funding available to meet this moment. We are out of money and nearly out of time. She goes on to warn that failing to provide the funds, quote, will kneecap Ukraine on the battlefield and let Putin and autocracy prevail. As for those drone attacks, U.S. Central Command said that three commercial ships were targeted in the southern Red Sea. The Navy destroyer USS Kearney responded to their distress calls and shot down the drones. There was no damage to the Kearney or any injuries to its personnel. At the White House, Jake Sullivan talked about whether those commercial ships had any ties to Israel.
I can't answer that definitively, but we don't think so. We do not believe that all three of the ships had ties to Israel, and it goes to show you the level of recklessness that the Houthis are operating on. any ship they shoot at, whether it's Israeli owned or has some connection in the past to Israel, that doesn't make it any more of a justifiable target under international law than if the ship didn't have ties to Israel. But some of these ships, we believe, may not have, although I don't want to give you a definitive answer on that because we have to continue to run that to ground. In addition to that, the position of the United States, consistent with the position of the UN Security Council and consistent with the position of maritime nations across the world, is that attacks on commercial shipping in international waters are totally unacceptable and have to stop. And what we are doing now is engaging in intensive consultations with partners and allies to determine the appropriate next steps. The last point I should make is just to underscore something I said in my opening statement. We are talking about the Houthis here. They're the ones with their finger on the trigger. But that gun, the weapons here are being supplied by Iran. And Iran, we believe, is the ultimate party responsible for this.
And with Hamas ending the latest ceasefire and fighting in Gaza resuming, what are the prospects for the release of more hostages as Israeli forces expand their action in Gaza?
There are still intensive discussions among us, Israel, Qatar, and Egypt about how to best get traction on a strategy that will get all the hostages out. But of course, for the United States, the paramount priority is getting the American hostages out. And we are talking to the president about all of his options in terms of securing the release of American hostages. Beyond that, I'm not going to comment because we need to be able to have those sensitive diplomatic discussions behind closed doors.
And just following up quickly on Mary's question, I know you said that you can't offer a comprehensive assessment about Israel's military operations since fighting resumed, but can you offer any kind of initial assessment, just based on what you've seen since Friday, of whether Israel appears to be taking a more surgical, more precise, more deliberate steps in its military operations since Friday?
Here's what I will say, because characterizing, like offering qualitative judgments like more this, less that, is just something I'm going to be very hesitant about doing. What I would prefer to do is just state facts as I see them. And the facts that I see over the course of the past few days are that Israel has identified a very specific area, has asked people to leave that area. Israel has actually coordinated the commencement of its military operations on the ground in the south with that kind of notification. Now, what I can't judge is how many of the people in that area as of right now have received that communication, because I'm not on the ground, so I don't know that. And what we have indicated to the Israelis is they need to use every means and tool that they have available to be sure that when they actually move in force into an area in the south, that they do so with some confidence that people have actually gotten safe passage out of that area. That's an ongoing conversation we have with them, but all I can tell you is that from our perspective, one of the key lessons from the North was to ensure that as you commence a ground operation, you have got to give civilians the time and capacity and real opportunity to leave. That is our position. That's what we intend to continue to reinforce privately and are happy to share publicly, because we think that that's basic, that that's the right thing to do. It's also the most effective way to actually see this whole operation through.
You're saying you won't make qualitative judgments, but other senior officials have done that in recent days, right? Talking about the operations that were focused in northern Gaza, talking about Israel heeding advice based on U.S.'s previous operations, you know, experience with urban warfare. So there does seem to be, I mean, we have heard that kind of judgment from other officials in the past, right?
Well, what you've heard, and you've heard it from me too, is the basic proposition that one innocent civilian killed is too many, and too many innocent civilians have died in this conflict. The Vice President has said that, Secretary Blinken has said that, I have said that. So that's a truth that does not require a kind of judgment that parses a particular act in a particular location. And so we will speak out on principle that the protection of civilians and operations consistent with the laws of war are fundamental and should be respected. And I have said that repeatedly from this podium. But when asked to characterize a precise comparison between northern Gaza and southern Gaza, particularly after just we're talking the course of a couple of days, I'm not in a position to stand up here and do that. But I will reinforce what all of my colleagues have said about the basic principles that undergird the U.S. approach to this issue.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan at today's White House briefing. At the United Nations today, Israeli officials presented evidence aimed at proving Hamas terrorists sexually assaulted victims during their October 7th attacks. USA Today quoting Israel's ambassador Gilad Erdan that the UN has, quote, completely ignored for almost 60 days and still cast doubt on evidence of the sexual assaults. Ambassador Erdan said that evidence comes from first responders at the sites where Hamas struck and from military reservists who worked to identify the bodies of those killed. The issue was also the subject of a report in yesterday's London Sunday Times. Here's State Department spokesman Matt Miller.
We've obviously seen the reports that Hamas has committed sexual violence. They've committed rape. We have no reason at all to doubt those reports. When you look at all the atrocities that Hamas carried out on October 7th and the atrocities that they have carried out since, the fact that they continue to hold women hostages, the fact that they continue to hold children hostages, the fact that it seems one of the reasons they don't want to turn women over that they've been holding hostage and the reason this pause fell apart is they don't want those women to be able to talk about what happened to them during their time in custody. Certainly, there is very little that I would put beyond Hamas when it comes to its treatment of civilians and particularly its treatment of women.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said last week that the reports of sexual assault, quote, must be vigorously investigated. Now back here in Washington and the topic of that U.S. help for Ukraine and Israel, here's Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
America's national security is on the line around the world, in Europe, in the Mideast, in Indochina. Autocrats and radical extremists are waging war against democracy, against our values, against our way of life. Before the year is out, it's important for Senate to pass an emergency national supplemental package, providing aid to Ukraine, to Israel, humanitarian aid to innocent civilians in Gaza, and deterrence against adversaries in the Indo-Pacific. Both parties understand the consequences will be severe if we fail. Just this morning, OMB Director Shalanda Young warned congressional leaders that that absent action from Congress, funding to help Ukraine will run out by the end of the year. Alarmingly, process on the national security package has been on ice for weeks, not because Republicans objected to Israel aid or aid to Ukraine or humanitarian aid to civilians, innocent civilians in Gaza or the Indo-Pacific, but because Republicans have injected partisan and extreme immigration measures into the debate. Let me repeat that. The holdup on the security supplemental has not been over Ukraine or Israel or the Indo-Pacific, but over Republican decision to inject hard right immigration measures into the debate. Democrats agree. Immigration should be debated and addressed. But if Republicans want to raise the issue of immigration right now, the onus is on them to present us with bipartisan ideas. Democrats have spent weeks, engaging in good faith on this issue. In fact, the president's supplemental proposal puts money directly towards vetting asylum claims, reducing court backlogs, stopping fentanyl, which is exactly what our Republican colleagues say they want. But instead of meeting us in the middle, Republicans have tripled down on extremist policies that seem dictated by Donald Trump and Stephen Miller, like indefinite detention of asylum seekers, sweeping powers to shut down the immigration system. Democrats want to be reasonable on immigration. We're willing to make concessions, but we will not keep going in circles if Republicans aren't interested in even meeting us halfway. Now, just because both sides can't reach an agreement does not mean that we can't get something done. But it must be broadly bipartisan. Neither side can dictate what can be in the bill, which is what many of our Republican colleagues seem to want. The two parties don't disagree seriously on Israel or Ukraine aid or humanitarian assistance to Gaza or the Indo-Pacific. We should therefore work towards passing these areas where we have bipartisan agreement. The world is watching what we do in Congress these coming weeks. You can bet Vladimir Putin is watching, Hamas is watching, Iran, President Xi, North Korea, all our adversaries. They're watching closely. If Congress fails to defend democracy in its hour of need, all because of border policies inspired by Donald Trump and Stephen Miller, the judgment of history will be harsh indeed.
Senator Schumer's Republican counterpart, Mitch McConnell, says border security is a fundamental part of any national security bill.
The Senate has less than 2 weeks to pass supplemental legislation on urgent national security priorities. As I've said for months, that means addressing both grave threats to America's interests overseas and a glaring border security crisis right here at home. Senate Republicans know that national security begins with border security. And we've made it crystal clear that in order to pass the Senate, any measure we take up in the coming days must include serious policy changes designed to get the Biden administration's border crisis under control. Apparently, some of our colleagues aren't ready to take that really seriously. Senator Langford, Senator Graham, and their fellow Republican negotiators are still at the table, working diligently on solutions. But from the White House to the Capitol, Washington Democrats are wasting time with bizarre public scoldings. Instead of engaging actively in the border security discussions required to complete a viable national security supplemental, the Biden administration has chosen to lecture Congress with a brag reel of its supposed leadership in countering Putin in Europe. The administration's account glossed over its record of self-deterrence toward Russia, insisting that, quote, the time to help a democratic Ukraine fight against Russian aggression is right now. If only President Biden had felt that sort of urgency in late 2021 and early 2022, as I and other Republicans urged the administration to give Ukraine the lethal assistance it needed to resist Putin's escalation. If only this lethal assistance and critical investments in cutting-edge capabilities for U.S. forces hadn't required so much prodding. Last week, at the Reagan National Defense Forum, the previous administration's former National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, made the case for supporting Ukraine. He pointed out, rightly, that helping degrade the military power of a major U.S. adversary is in America's national security interest, and that we shouldn't hesitate to give Ukraine the weapons it needs to do the job.
Floor remarks from Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell and Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today. And what does the week look like for Israel and Ukraine aid? Here's Politico congressional reporter Anthony Adragna.
So Majority Leader Chuck Schumer in the Senate has indicated that his chamber would look to vote on a package this week. We heard last week as they were leaving a lot of Republican senators saying they were prepared to filibuster that, essentially vote that down on the floor. Perhaps that jumpstarts the negotiations on the border security aspect of this, which they have been insistent on. But I think that's to be seen. And then there's a whole different conversation about whether or not anything that gets through the Senate can actually get through the really narrowly divided House. House Republicans have been even more insistent on including the bulk of their border security package that they passed earlier this year as part of this supplemental.
So dig into what we mean by border security. What are the specific asks here?
I think part of the complexity and the nuance here, as anyone who's followed negotiations on Capitol Hill knows, immigration has been something approaching a white whale. So there have been progress on provisions with asylum. Republicans have been very insistent about trying to claw back, severely restrict asylum as part of immigration talks. There's also been a push from House Republicans to fund the border security wall that people remember from the Trump era. And so those are kind of the crux of it, but obviously those negotiations are really complex, a lot of different moving parts there. And the details are obviously going to matter quite a bit in terms of getting any through either of those chambers.
And then is it your expectation that it's more likely that we'll see separate aid packages instead of the one big aid package that the White House originally asked for here?
It's really tough to say. I think, obviously, time is really short. Both chambers are really supposed to be leaving town at the end of next week for the holidays. So things don't move very quickly on Capitol Hill unless they do. But I'd be really surprised to see separate packages moving at this point. It seems like it's going to kind of be all or nothing. And I think the question is whether or not there could be some sort of border security language in there that satisfies that Republican demand and gets these other international aid components through.
Things move slowly until they don't. So take us to a House impeachment inquiry vote, a formal vote on these impeachment probes. Speaker Johnson now saying he has the votes for that. When are we likely to see that? It seems like he's set on having that vote on the floor of the House.
Yeah, certainly I think the tone changed pretty significantly from senior Republican leadership last week, now indicating they want to move as quickly as before they break for the holidays. And so that would be a formal vote to authorize the impeachment inquiry. That would not be a vote on the impeachment of President Biden. I think that's a crucial dynamic to underscore here. That's what's gotten a lot of moderate Republicans who are still not on board with necessarily impeaching Joe Biden. There's not been any smoking gun found of any wrongdoing from the president. But moderate Republicans now seem, they feel as though they've been sort of stonewalled. They haven't gotten access to the information that they'd like. And I think that's what's motivating a lot of them to be open, newly open, to authorizing an impeachment inquiry.
And the idea is that a formal vote authorizing an impeachment inquiry would give more legal heft to these inquiries and shake loose maybe more witnesses or more documents, right?
That is the argument that people have been advancing, yes.
We're talking about the end of the congressional calendar year. How many days do we have left? Besides these two very big things, an impeachment inquiry and then emergency aid, what else is on the calendar?
A lot of things. There's the annual defense policy bill that still needs to get done before the end of the year. There's the debate over this sunsetting controversial surveillance program known as Section 02 for all of us Capitol Hill nerds up here.
702?
702. And then, obviously, I think we're expecting some sort of resolution with the military holds that Senator Tommy Tuberville has had in the Senate for months now. Hundreds of promotions that have been held up, and I think the dam appears to be close to breaking on that. Exactly what the escape route looks like, I think we're all still waiting to find out. But we're expecting movement on that potentially as quickly as soon as this week.
Potential avenues for an escape route, as you describe it. How could they get around it?
I think the most compelling one that I've heard is to look to the courts. Obviously, this has been over the Pentagon's abortion travel policy has been what Senator Tuberville has cited for maintaining these holds. And so he's indicated perhaps being open to a legal course of action, throw this to the courts and let them weigh in. And maybe that gives him enough comfort to relax some of these holds and allow them to move.
And then, of course, the next government funding deadline isn't until January 19th due to that continuing resolution. But is there much work going on in this next week or two, or is it all being saved to the clock ticking down to January 19th and do that all in the new year?
Folks are saying that they're working right now, but I think with experience, you tend to have people not really – people often say they're able to walk and chew gum at the same time. But I've not really found that to be the case. I'd be surprised if we see a lot of real movement there until after the new year. But yeah, fun for those of us who are not used to having Decembers without a looming government shutdown.
Politico congressional reporter Anthony Adrogna. You can see more from him along with today's White House briefing, today's State Department briefing, and our complete House and Senate coverage at cspan.org and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. You're listening to Washington Today.
People often think C-SPAN is funded by the federal government. In fact, we're a nonprofit organization that receives no government funding. As news consumption changes, you can help ensure the future of C-SPAN's unfiltered coverage of national government and politics. We hope you'll consider making a tax-deductible contribution that will support our daily editorial operations. To learn more, visit cspan.org/donate.
In this ad for the Mobile One brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobile One, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
Welcome back to Washington Today. As I mentioned earlier, the Justice Department has arrested a former U.S. ambassador on charges of secretly working to promote Cuban interests in the U.S. Victor Manuel Rocha has been charged with conspiracy to act as a foreign agent to defraud the United States, acting as an illegal agent for a foreign government, and use of a passport obtained by a false statement. Here's the announcement from Attorney General Merrick Garland.
This action exposes one of the highest-reaching and longest-lasting infiltrations of the U.S. government by a foreign agent. Specifically, the criminal complaint alleges that for over 40 years, Rocha acted as a covert agent of the Cuban government. To that end, the complaint alleges Rocha sought out employment with the U.S. government that would provide him with access to non-public information and the ability to affect U.S. foreign policy. Between 1981 and 2002, Rocha was employed at the State Department and held a number of senior positions in the U.S. government. Those included service on the National Security Council with special responsibility for Cuba, among other things. It included service as deputy principal officer at the U.S. Interest Section in Havana, Cuba. And it included service as the U.S. ambassador to Bolivia from 1999 to 2002. After leaving the State Department, Rocha served as an advisor to the commander of the U.S. Southern Command. The area of responsibility of that U.S. military command includes Cuba. The complaint alleges that Rocha sought out and used his positions within the United States government to support Cuba's clandestine intelligence gathering mission against the United States. After the FBI received information that Rocha was a covert agent of Cuba's intelligence service, an FBI undercover proceeded to engage with Rocha on several occasions. As detailed in the complaint, Rocha repeatedly referred to the United States as, quote, the enemy. During the undercover, he told the undercover that his efforts to infiltrate the United States government were, quote, meticulous and, quote, very disciplined. And he repeatedly bragged about the significance of his efforts, saying that, quote, what has been done has strengthened the revolution immensely.
According to the DOJ complaint, an undercover FBI agent allegedly reached out to Victor Rocha via WhatsApp in November of last year. That led to three meetings, November 16th of last year, and then on February 17th and June 23rd of this year. That's when Mr. Rocha allegedly boasted about his longtime loyalty to Havana. The 73-year-old was expected to make his first appearance before a federal judge today in Miami. Back here in Washington, Vermont Democratic Senator Peter Welch was part of an event focusing on U.S. foreign policy at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He talked about the situation in Ukraine, the Middle East, and what he thinks is at stake for the U.S.
The post-World War II order, where you don't use force to take territory from a sovereign country. And the rules of diplomatic engagement as opposed to the rules of military engagement. That's really what's at stake. I have confidence that we're going to get there. There's a battle brewing now, obviously, in the House and in the Senate about this. But there continues to be very strong bipartisan support. I mean, Senator McConnell is very, very strong and eloquent in his defense of U.S. continued engagement with Ukraine. What's going to be happening this week and the next week is the question of the border, which is always a very, very tough political issue, getting conjoined with Israeli aid and getting conjoined with Ukraine aid. It's not a pretty situation to watch over in Capitol Hill most of the time, even when things are going well. But I think somehow, some way, we'll get to where we need to be on this.
Mr. Senator, you've mentioned Republican colleagues. that you share a common sense of purpose with and a common commitment to solve problems. When you watch the news in America, you might come to the impression that examples of that are few and far between. Do you still see bipartisanship as one of the bedrock pillars of our foreign policy and national security, or do you wish it to be a pillar?
You know, I've never seen a problem that gets resolved without working with people you disagree with. So, you know, bipartisanship is essential to have durable resolutions. And that requires give and take, obviously.
Vermont Democratic Senator Peter Welch in an event at the U.S. Institute of Peace today. You can see all of his remarks at cspan.org. According to a 2022 study by researchers at the UC San Francisco School of Nursing, the use of electronic cigarettes costs the U.S. $15 billion annually in healthcare expenditures. That's more than $2,000 per person per year. E-cigarettes and the regulation was the topic of conversation today at an event hosted at the American Enterprise Institute. One of the event participants was Indiana Republican Representative Larry Bouchon, who is also a cardiothoracic surgeon.
But I think the basic fundamentals of this space are is that government bans and those type of things don't really work. I mean, we've tried that over the years. Education does work. I think we had some success probably 20, maybe 30 years ago, starting in the schools. It has to start young. You have to educate young people about something that can happen to them when they're adults many, many years later, and that the downside of using these products from a medical perspective is there. And I think we've had some success in the education space doing that over the years. I think in the United States at least, the number of people who smoke cigarettes or use tobacco products, let me just say this. My dad quit smoking, they continued to chew tobacco products, is lower than it has been historically. But worldwide, as you probably know, it's particularly in Asia, it's still a pretty substantial problem from a medical perspective. So I think the one thing you need to do is make sure whatever your regulatory process is that you recognize banning, specifically completely banning products, doesn't necessarily work. You will create a black market for these products. That's been shown in other countries, and it will happen true also in the United States. But you need to educate people and then make them, you know, so that they can make informed decisions about how they choose to utilize these products.
Indiana Republican Representative Larry Bouchon speaking earlier today at the American Enterprise Institute. That entire event is available to see at cspan.org. Campaign 2024 news now. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum announced today he is suspending his presidential campaign. In a statement, he said, quote, "Our decision to run for president came from a place of caring deeply about every American and a mission to reestablish trust in America's leadership and our institutions of democracy. While this primary process has shaken my trust in many media organizations and political party institutions, it has only strengthened my trust in America." The conservative second-term governor launched his campaign back in June. His top issues were the economy, energy, and national security. California Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell is predicting former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy will leave Congress by the end of the year. He posted on X over the weekend, quote, "With Santos gone, you're hearing it here first. The next GOP member to leave Congress will be at Speaker McCarthy." Of course, that's a reference to the now former New York Republican Representative George Santos, who was expelled from Congress on Friday. Representative Swalwell went on to say, quote, "No way he stays. A guy who kidney punches his colleagues from behind is too afraid to serve out a full term with them. I bet he's gone by the end of the year. What say you?" That kidney punch comment is a reference to Tennessee Republican Tim Burchett's claim that Representative McCarthy deliberately elbowed him as the two passed by each other in a hallway at the Capitol last month. Representative McCarthy has denied that contact was deliberate. And former Congresswoman Liz Cheney is saying she believes Donald Trump would refuse to leave office if he is reelected next year. The Wyoming Republican, who served as vice chair of the House January 6th committee, writes in her new book, Oath and Honor, a Memoir and a Warning, that she thinks American democracy is on the ballot in 2024.
It certainly is, you know, and Donald Trump has told us exactly what he will do. He will not abide by the rulings of the courts. He will certainly appoint people to office, whether or not they can be confirmed by the Senate. He has talked about using the military in terms that really are fundamentally un-American, including here in the United States. So it's a very dangerous moment, and it's a moment for people to understand that that cannot be the path that we go down as a country.
Just yesterday in an interview, you said fundamentally there's a choice to be made. You can't be both for Donald Trump and for the Constitution. You have to choose.
Yeah.
A vote for Donald Trump is unconstitutional, anti-American.
Well, he won't support and uphold the Constitution. We've already seen what happened. He is the only president in American history who attempted to overturn an election, who attempted to seize power, to stay in power after he had lost. And the reason that we didn't have a much more serious crisis was because there were people around him who stopped him, because there were people around the country, state officials, for example, who stopped him, who did not yield to the pressure that he put on them to change votes from Biden to Trump. We won't have that safeguard again. And he's so dangerous. If you have a president who is unwilling to abide by the rulings of the courts, who's unwilling to uphold the Constitution, then there are no guardrails who can stop him.
You've said we're sort of sleepwalking into dictatorship in the United States. Dictatorship. Is that what we would have if we reelect Donald Trump?
I think it's a very, very real threat and concern. And I don't say any of that lightly. And frankly, it's painful for me as someone who, you know, has spent her whole life in Republican politics, who grew up as a Republican, to watch what's happening to my party and to watch the extent to which Donald Trump himself has basically determined that the only thing that matters is him, his power, his success, and that is not somebody you can entrust with the power of the president.
Former Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney speaking on the Today Show earlier today. You can find more of our campaign 2024 coverage at cspan.org. And don't forget our new weekly wrap-up 2024 campaign trail. It's a one-stop shop to see where the candidates are traveling across the country and what they're saying to voters. You'll also get perspective from political reporters, the latest poll and fundraising numbers, and campaign ads. You can watch 2024 Campaign Trail on Friday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN, and you can stream it anytime at cspan.org and download it as a podcast on our free C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you get your podcasts. That's also where you can find this program as a podcast, and it's on YouTube. Just search Washington Today. And for more on the stories that are shaping Washington every day, get our free daily email, word for word. You can go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe to that. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.